You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We have an excellent show for you today, if I say so myself, featuring the wonderful Graham Bartlett, Katie Massey and Tanya Byrne. All three Brighton writers writing completely different things. These are really interesting and dynamic conversations, which I found really inspiring. So I really hope you enjoy the show. The book club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. Please do rate, review and subscribe and share with your book loving friends. You can find us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. After losing her sister to a drug overdose, Chief Superintendent Jo Howe is desperate to tackle the world of drugs that consumes the shadowy backstreets of Brighton. Operation Eradicate is her response, deploying undercover tactics to collapse drug circles while also providing treatment services to victims of drug abuse. But not everyone sees this as a positive development. The man behind Respite Pharmaceuticals, billionaire Sir Sean Parsons, views Operation Eradicate as a threat to his business. His colossal empire relies on burgeoning numbers of addicts who survive on their substitute drugs. With connections in the highest levels of government, media and organised crime, Sir Ben unleashes a brutal counterattack on Jo. The question is, how will she survive this fierce onslaught? Graham Bartlett, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. Very excited about this.
And congratulations on the publication of City on Fire, which is the third in your Jo Howe crime books.
That's right. Yeah. Number three. I never thought I'd get to one. So to get to three is, can't quite believe it.
So will you give us a kind of brief overview of the series?
So Jo Howe is the Chief Superintendent of Brighton Police, which was a job I used to do. She kind of got the job reluctantly and by the downfall of somebody very close to her. And since then, she's been tackling the negative impact of politics and life, really, in Brighton and Hove. So the first book, Bad for Good, was kind of all about what happens when police cuts are so bad that vigilantism takes over as the crime control method of choice. And so she's battling the vigilantes and also trying to find the killer of her former lover's son. And her former lover happens to be the former chief superintendent in Brighton. So it's all very complex there. The second one is she's somehow an extreme right-wing council has been elected into Brighton. This is Force of Hate. And they are using various methods to ethnically cleanse the city and also to fund an as yet unknown terrorist atrocity. And this one, City on Fire, is all about what happens when pharmaceutical companies decide that the war against drugs is actually not something that should be won, and the lengths they'll go to fight their own war against those looking to improve the lives of others.
This is, your books are really set in Brighton's kind of underbelly. Apart from the obvious facts of proximity, what is appealing to you about setting a book here?
Well, they say write what you know, and I think I take that to an extreme, really, because I used to be the police commander for Brighton and Hove and worked most of my 30-year police career in Brighton and Hove. And it's such a fascinating city. It's got so many extremes. There's extreme wealth, extreme poverty. There's so many wonderful things that go on in the city, but also so much crime and so much deprivation and so much sort of examples of people doing dreadful things to others. So there's such a spectrum to draw on there. And because it once had the title of drugs death capital of the UK, even previously, it was known long before my time as the murder capital of Europe. You know, it's got a real dark underbelly that people who visit for day trips and for the sport or the nightlife don't necessarily see.
Absolutely. That's not the first thing you think about when you come on a stag do here.
No, definitely not. No. I'm the world's worst tourist advisor for Brighton because I only see the dark side.
So you've had a really interesting journey into becoming a published author, and I know that that journey involves the wonderful Peter James, who we previously had on the show. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I met Peter when I was when I was sort of one of the command officers at Brighton. I think I was the superintendent at the time, and Peter had this relationship that he'd had for some time with Sussex Police, where he would come in and we would talk to him about what we did, and not the kind of sensitive secret stuff, but just so he could get an idea of the world of policing. And you know, we got to know each other quite well there. And then when I retired from the police, you know, I said to him, you know, if you ever want any help on your books and advising, you know, on the authenticity, he already had Dave Gaylor, who is a friend of mine, doing that as well. He said, yeah, that's fine. You know, it's a bit more up to date than Dave had left before me. And then Peter came up with this idea of writing a nonfiction called Death Comes Knocking, Policing Roy Grace's Brighton. He'd been asked to write nonfictions before, but didn't feel that he had the voice or authenticity to do it, because he didn't, obviously he'd never been in the police. He'd only seen this from the touchline, as it were. So he asked me to co-write it with him, which was a wonderful opportunity and something I never thought, I mean, it never entered my mind to be a writer. I wasn't one of these people that kind of was writing since the age of four or anything like that. And it just kind of took off, really. I found that I could do it. You know, obviously it was a hard slog and lots of gentle and not so gentle feedback from Peter on the way through. We wrote two nonfictions, but eventually, you know, we got there, and that's how I found my love of writing.
So let's talk about your protagonist, Jo Howe. How did she form as a character, and why did you decide to write a female lead?
So I wanted Jo to not be a typical senior police officer. I wanted to write as from the perspective of a senior police officer, because not many do, not many write from that senior, and that was a role I did, and I knew there was plenty of drama in that role, but quite often crime writers write that level almost as sort of narcissistic, self-serving, operationally inept, career hungry people, and you know, my experience is that, you know, there are very, very few like that, and most have come up through the ranks, you know, have got their operational spurs and really do their absolute best for the place they work in and the staff that are working with them. So I wanted somebody to be in that role who was not that kind of stereotype, as it were. And I the reason I wrote the character as a woman is as a debut novelist, as I was, I've written nonfiction, but as a debut novelist, I didn't want to drift into it being too autobiographical. So if I had a bloke in my mind when I was writing, you know, I might inadvertently kind of superimpose myself on him. So I thought, well, you know, an easy way not to do that is to write it as a woman. I'm thinking as a woman then. And then of course I thought, well, actually, there's more to it than just not being autobiographical. You know, that women and women senior officers have far more of a challenge than I ever did. You know, it was tough for me to get to the level I did, but for a woman to get to it, you know, they had to work twice as hard and be, you know, be flawless to get to the positions that Jo is. So, yeah, so I work with a lot of brilliant senior women, and I kind of spent a lot of time with them, and I found that talking to them and their journeys and their experiences was just made for such a far more interesting character than I would have done if I'd have just put, you know, a white middle-aged bloke there.
Can you read us some, please, Graham?
Yeah, certainly. So just to set the scene, this is from close to the beginning of City on Fire. So Jo Howe has set up an operation called Operation Eradicate, which is that the principles of the operation is to get drug users into treatment, so out of courts and into treatment, and get drug dealers into prison. So every so often they run an arrest phase where they arrest swathes of drug dealers who have been caught through undercover tactics. But when they do that, they deploy other officers and drug workers to basically support the users who won't be able to get they're fixed for the day. So it's a kind of two-pronged thing. So we meet, the section I'm going to read is, we meet a sergeant called Scotty and his PC called Sarah. And they work on the street community team. So they're the ones that are getting people into treatment. And they're out while these arrests are being made with a drugs worker called Lizzie, who we find out, it's not a spoiler, we find out is actually having an affair with Scotty. I know, terrible. So they're just, they've just turned into Oriental Place in Brighton, just off the seafront. They've seen a group of users milling around looking for their dealer. Scotty drops Sarah and Lizzie off by a builder's van, cover enough for the low-key surprise they were used to springing, while he drove past the group and pulled up beyond them. He parked up, slowly got out of the car, and ambled towards the group, as Sarah and Lizzie did the same from the opposite direction. As he closed in, Scotty recognised all but one and knew they'd have little fight in them. Anticipating them running, though, he readied himself. He was proud to see the other two mirror him, both only in the middle of the road, their arms out at 45 degrees. It was a pale, scraggy young woman who made the first move. Her efforts to power walk past Scotty lasted no more than a few seconds as the huge sergeant stretched out his right arm. "Now that's just rude, Trish. Fancy not even stopping to chat." A couple of men met the same end trying to edge past Sarah, and soon all six were huddled between Lizzie and the two officers. "Now what are you all up to?" Scotty asked as he switched on his body-worn video camera, its red light flashing to say it was active. "As if I can't guess." It was Trish Kenyon who became the spokesperson. "We ain't doing no harm. Just let us score and then we'll be out of your hair." "Well, I'm afraid that's a bit of a problem today," said Sarah. "See, our colleagues have been sweeping up the dealers. And well, most of your gear is now in our drugstore." The panic was palpable. These, like every other addict, had just one goal in life. "But we don't cause no trouble, but we'll be clucking in a couple of hours. You lot keep doing this and no one gives a monkeys about us." Lizzie stepped forward. "It doesn't have to be like this, you know." "Oh, no, not the op eradicate chat again," said Trish as she tried to walk away. Scotty stepped across, blocking her path. Just then, a furniture lorry trundled down the road. "Come on, let's do this on the pavement," said Sarah, shepherding them out of the truck's way. Lizzie continued. "Well, if you've heard it before, you know the deal. You can come with me and we'll get you enrolled on one of the funded treatment programs today. No waiting lists, no eligibility criteria. One form if you're in. Do that and we'll be here to get you off drugs and crime." Her hand gesture included Scotty and Sarah in that pledge. "And if we don't," the only person Scotty didn't recognise said, "then we hound you. Nick you for walking on the cracks in the pavement. And when you tell the magistrates you need to go into treatment, we show them this video," said Scotty, tapping the camera. "Some call it assertive outreach. I prefer Hobson's choice." Just then, a blue panel van crawled up the road. Scotty barely glanced as it eased to a silent stop. It was only when the side door flew open that his antenna was spooked. Three masked, stocky men jumped out, one of them shouting, "Get 'em!" They closed the 2-meter gap in half as many seconds, blades flashing in their clenched fists. Sarah stabbed the red button on her airwave radio and screamed, "Code Zero, Oriental Place!" This was the call that trumped all others, sparking every available officer to come running. It also left her microphone open for a few precious seconds. "Urgent assistance, plainclothes officers and one civvy being attacked by three with knives." Scotty drew his baton and his Parva spray, holding the stick in an aggressive stance while aiming the synthetic pepper solution at his attacker's eyes and simultaneously roaring, "Get back, get back!" Sarah shouted the same, rushing to their flank. She swung her own baton with at the right-hand man's knees, but missed the target. The distant sirens were a welcome sound, but Scotty knew they couldn't hold the knifeman back for too long. The blade swished terrifyingly close, and Scotty's spray canister was all but empty. Just then, he notched up a hit with a burning liquid as the middleman clapped to his knees, holding his eyes and screaming. This only drove the others on, and Scotty could only focus on the next few seconds. He bellowed louder and saw Sarah draw her own spray and take aim. Suddenly, the two in front of them stopped and dragged their stricken colleague to the van. "Thank God," thought Scotty as they retreated. Then he felt a fourth person barge past him from behind. He glanced and saw it as one of the original group he didn't recognise. Scotty tried to grabbed the man, but the man slipped away and jumped into his van milliseconds before it sped away. Scotty was about to run after him when he heard, "Help me," to his left. He looked round and to his horror, he saw Lizzie writhing on the ground, eyes bleeding and blood jetting across the front wing of a white Vauxhall Corsa she was wedged against.
Oh my gosh, wow, that is all action. I say this a lot with crime writers, but you're such a nice, mild-mannered man. Horrific things.
Get it all on the page. You don't need to yeah. live it in life then.
So what's the reaction been, Graham, to the series so far? And do you feel that there's extra pressure to get procedures correct as a former police officer?
Well, I've been absolutely amazed by the reaction. People really love the books, really love Joe. They really empathise with Joe. And, she's got her flaws. You know, she's got terrible imposter syndrome. She can be irritable. She's a bit of a control freak. But people love her because of that, I think, because of her humanity. And of course, the themes are very contemporary. You know, they are in the world that we live now, and I think people appreciate that. But in terms of procedures, I mean, because I advise probably 150 other authors, I run courses on procedure, both online and in person, teach on university programs, all sorts of things. But I always talk about having authentic procedures. And plausible, credible stories and characters, never realism, because if you're realistic, then you've actually got quite a boring book on your hands, or a textbook even. So I try and live this with my own writing, is that, you know, the way that I write the policing is not exactly as it would be, because, as I say, it would be incredibly bureaucratic, dull and slow paced. But it's how it could be. How it should be. So I do feel a certain amount of pressure to get things right, and I use advisors myself. I've talked about, you know, the senior women officers, people like Di Roskilly and Lisa Bell, who I've worked with, who advised on that side of things. You know, I used to be a firearms commander, but I appreciate that I'm a bit out of date, so I use firearms officers to help me in those areas, and in any other area I feel that I need support in, as every other writer should do. You know, it's about just understanding how things are and taking a creative veer from that where it's necessary.
Absolutely. So you mentioned consulting for other crime writers. What are some of the most commonly asked questions you get?
How quickly can we get DNA back? It's one of them. What do pathologists actually do at crime scenes? What is the process when people are arrested? And some of the common things that people get wrong are the ranks of their officers. I mean, albeit I'm writing a chief superintendent as my protagonist, she's operating at the level of a chief superintendent. Some people attempted to have very senior officers doing things like interviewing and arrests and that doesn't happen. People get confused around the structures of policing. They'll have the New Scotland Yard coming in to take over a murder investigation, or which never happens. People get, you know, I talked about the DNA forensic issues, forensic timelines is an issue, and also some of the covert tactics and how they're deployed and what's possible as well. You know, I mean, some people are overly ambitious about what they think is possible, and some people don't realise actually that, you know, the police can put bugs in cars and houses and put undercover officers. I mean, there's an undercover theme in City on Fire. You know, they don't realise they can do that. So they're the sorts of things. But what I try to do is work with authors so their story remains at the core of everything. And some tweaks around the edges might be necessary to make the procedures or the characters authentic and plausible, but I try not to wreck their story, because that, you know, that's just not polite, is it? When people have put their life into writing this story and I go, oh, that would never happen. I'll try and find a way to make it happen.
You are a writer in Brighton, or just outside of Brighton. What is that like? What's your community like here?
Do you know what? I don't know what it's like in other areas, so I've got nothing to compare it to. But it's just incredible that the number and the generosity of crime writers in Brighton. it's just overwhelming. I mean, I'm in a small writing group with some very prominent authors in Brighton. I won't name them because we try and sort of, you know, it's a kind of bit of a self-help group, but with some very, very prominent authors, household names that people will know. And there are, you know, there are others who, you know, people like Jack Jordan and Ellie Griffiths and people like that. You can literally, you can pick the phone up to and go, oh, I'm a bit stuck here, give us a hand. And they will drop everything and help. And, you know, it's quid pro quo, but there's such a big community. And it's really interesting because, you know, obviously people only have a certain amount of money to spend on books. And, you know, we're all, crime writing is a very crowded genre. Lots and lots of writers and lots of stories, great stories, great books, you know, some of them, you know, well publicized, others not so. But there's never this feeling of competition. You know, I never feel that I'm kind of, you know, I'm up against so-and-so for sales, you know, because of this collegiate attitude that pervades the whole crime writing community, particularly Brighton and Hove.
Thank you so much for coming on, Graham. How can we find out for you?
So my website is www.policeadvisor.co.uk, and I'm on X, formerly known as Twitter, as GB Police Advisor, also on Instagram as GB Police Advisor, and on Facebook, my author page is Graham Bartlett, author and police procedure advisor, or something like that. You'll see it anyway. You'll recognise my face, or you know, I'm sitting on a stack of books in the image, so it just gives it away.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you.
Leeds 1977. A chill lies over the city. Sex workers are being murdered by a serial killer they are calling the Ripper, the streets creeping with fear. Tough, sharp, but tender Maureen runs Rio's, a clean, discreet brothel in the city. She's a good boss who takes great care of her workers, especially her best girls, Bev and Annette. The Ripper may be terrifying girls who work the street, but at Rio's, the girls seem safer. But when Bev's sweet-natured son is found beaten to death, a figure from Maureen's past, DS Mick Honeyford, shows up at her door. Does his arrival herald danger or salvation? And who can Maureen really trust? Katie Massey, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thanks, Anna. It's lovely to be back.
So congratulations on the publication of All Us Sinners. Can you talk a bit about the inspiration behind the book? Why this book and why now?
Well, I wrote a memoir that came out a couple of years ago. It actually came out in 2020 in the depth of COVID, but I try not to mention the C word. And it talked about the way I grew up, which was my mum was in the sex industry, made quite a bit of money, sent me to boarding school, and sort of changed the trajectory of my life. And I wanted to write a book that drew on those women that I knew who worked for her. But I also wanted to write a book that talked about the importance of women being able to work together, which is still illegal. And at this time, it was... It's shocking that I'm having this conversation with you now in 2023, in the wake of Sarah Everard and the way that particularly the way that the Metropolitan Police has sort of fallen in terms of its trust among women. And I thought that not enough had changed.
Can you speak a bit about the research that went into writing the book? Because I know obviously some of it is informed by your real life experience, but I know that some of it, and especially the Ripper stuff, will have taken quite a lot of research.
Yeah, it's an interesting process, is the Ripper research, because there are, particularly online, there is a very, very active and very, very interested serial killer community who like to discuss various theories. I was really conscious of not glamorizing Peter Sutcliffe in the course of this, and I was also conscious of keeping him in the background, because he's a larger than life historical figure now that steals all the oxygen in every room. A bit like somebody like Jimmy Savile, and both of them have recently been the subject of TV series recently. So I think it was important that he was there, because in Ipswich, in Bradford since, there have been killers who have similarly targeted sex workers. So it was important that there was somebody in the background who was taking advantage of women's vulnerability. And by vulnerability, actually, I don't just mean working on the streets, I mean poverty. And I think there were things that I wanted to talk about, the problem of getting work that fits in around childcare, for instance, the problem of women having to work together to stay safe, but in doing so, breaking the law. There were things that I wanted to talk about that I had to write this book to do so.
Do you feel kind of catharsis and release in having got all of this onto the page?
No, I wish I could say yes. So I was far too concerned about making it a darn good read, and plotting it. And the plot took a lot of work. I dare say I'm not a natural in plotting. I love setting and I love characterization and I love writing about weather and those descriptive passages and all of that stuff. I love all of that. But I had to really, really buckle down and make it a gripping tale. And in doing that, I found that I just don't think that the position of women, how many years later are we talking? We're talking, getting on for 50 years later. I just don't think the position of women has come forward enough for me to feel a sense of catharsis. I felt a sense of deja vu, to be absolutely honest with you.
Wow. So this is your first published novel, and it follows your memoir, Are We Home Yet? So you've spoken a bit about this, but I'd love to go a bit further into it about the difference between writing memoir and then writing fiction, kind of beyond plotting.
Okay. Right, so my memoir is a memoir and not a thinly disguised autobiographical first novel because truth is stranger than fiction. And I found that in my memoir, there were too many really dominant themes jostling for attention. So it's not just about the sex industry, it's about immigration and it's about coming to a new country and making a life, as both sets of my parents did. When my mum's family from Canada, the French part of Canada, and my father from Jamaica, it's about mental health challenges. I had a brother who very sadly committed suicide. So any one of those themes could dominate a fictive text. And I did try and fictionalize it at one stage, because nobody, I was told just a normal person never gets a memoir published. Like, unless you're outstanding in some way, or, held political power or been an athlete or done this, that would never be published. So I did try and fictionalize it. And I found that I cut in the fictionalization, I ended up cutting my mum's brothel out of the fictionalized version, which sounds kind of against my purpose. And it turned out to be against my purpose. As I was reading it, I was like, no, I'm not. I'm writing around things that I want to that go through. Whereas in fiction, you have to be believable, you have to be plausible. Whereas in life is random and it's extreme and it's messy.
Can you read some for us, please, Katie, from All Our Sinners?
I certainly can. This is I had to it took some thinking about what to read you because I didn't want to ruin the plot. So for anybody who might be diving in and have no idea what the book's about. So I'll read two pages, and this is my main character, Maureen. And I also make reference to Betty, who is her mother. And there's some language that I'm going to try and work around. And it's about her getting ready to go to a real life nightclub, actually, in Manchester called the Reno. If you Google the Reno, it's been subject to various sort of artistic excavations and treatments, and because it meant so much to particularly the mixed race population of the North. It's closed down many years ago, but we're in 1977 here. So Dermot didn't turn up that night, but he phoned Maureen at Rio's the next afternoon. He made an excuse Maureen didn't want to listen too closely to, something about helping out Albert at the pub. Vaguely, she remembered Albert drank at the Fiddler's, and the old boy always needed a hand lifting or moving something, his telly, his food shop, that his limbs had grown too weak to carry. During their short chat, she waited on tenterhooks and received her wish when he suggested that they meet that night instead. She immediately agreed. She immediately agreed. Hope once again in full flame. Getting dressed, she felt like the kind of teenager she'd never been. It had been Dermot's suggestion. There was pleasure in his voice as he said it was time she took him out. He was on her turf after all. And everyone dressed up for the Reno. The place had a bit of style, its own look, but it had been years since she'd bothered to make the trip, back before Rio's took all her energy. Now, a gin down and a music on, she felt like she was getting closer to it. Earth, Wind and Fire's bass stretched the fabric on the speaker grill, just like it used to. For a few years in her 20s, she spent every penny she earned in the Reno, while bass like that vibrated through her feet, up her thighs, and made her hips move automatically. She'd had fun, too, most of the time. This was probably when she last got ready with this level of anticipation. Her spliff smouldered gently in the cut grass ashtray, and she picked it up and puffed on it carefully so as not to ruin her lipstick, pink and frosty. She'd done her hair on curlers last night. Now her soft curls were round, bouncy curls, big and glassy with setting lotion. She grabbed one of the outsized ringlets and snarled at it. Her hair was too soft to hold an afro, but she hadn't been aiming for Shirley Bloody Bastard either. She drew bitter smoke deep into her lungs, exhaled and took another look. Yeah, okay, eff it. She'd be Shirley Bastard tonight. All right, this was happening. She was gently stoned, loosened and swaying to the music. She could already feel the sweaty Reno crowd grooving, smell the flog of sensimilia, see the way it turned the condensation running down the pine-clad walls nicotine yellow. It was nearly time to go, and she still didn't know what to wear. A phrase drifted into her mind. If in doubt, wear black. Betty was usually right, and the answer suddenly was hanging in front of her, a funeral dress. Short, black cross-grained silk with chiffon arms, a bit Jean Shrimpton, a bit Bette Lynch, and a long white boots because it was always freezing in Manchester and they were sexy as well as warm. Choices made, she tucked it all on in double quick time and was downstairs in about 5 minutes. Linford had left the keys to his Cortina right in the middle of the cafe's empty counter, like an offering poised on an altar. It was clear the slightest scratch would be an unforgivable sin. It's only a car, she muttered to herself. And if he'd been around, she'd have told him so. But it was Friday night, sacrosanct in Linford's book. He'd let her have the car, but acted as if it was under duress. Be careful with her, Mo. My pride and joy. He'd be out himself, hunting skirt.
Oh, that was such a good reading. Thank you, Katie. I love Maureen.
Oh, well, I'm glad you do. I absolutely love her. Too, and I love writing about her, and I'm writing the second one at the moment, and it's been just a real joy to spend more time in her company.
So one of my questions is always what's next for you, so I guess this would be a good time to ask it. There's going to be a sequel to All Our Sinners.
There is, yes. So I was asked by Sphere, who are the publisher, to write a second book, but a second book in this potential series. So, and it's been a real pleasure to bring her forward as a character, to open her up to the world, because weirdly, her job means that she spends a long time in a sauna called Rio's on her working, and maybe 80 hours a week she's there. So it's been a pleasure to bring her out, to show her that she can be somebody in the world, that she can be confident. And her sort of vehicle for doing that is her policeman partner. And they're unconventional crime fighting partners, I guess, but he's known her on and off for 20 years. And he sees that she's mixed race, sweet, street smart, a woman, good looking, and that she can go places that really, he's a sort of 6 foot bald headed walrus mustache, middle aged cop. And he tends to stand out in places like the Reno's where she can go. So that it's actually a joy to sort of let her back out again.
Amazing. So I know you were a journalist before turning your hand to writing in a different way. Did your journalistic experience inspire the kind of investigative elements of All Our Sinners?
You know, I hadn't thought about that, Anna, but I think you might be right, because the new book has a journalist character. And it's a bit like, I hate to say this, but sex workers and journalists have something in common in that they're both given information and have to be trusted. You've got to trust them. And they're sort of allowed to ask questions and to go places that other people are not really allowed to go. And that's both in terms of emotionally, in terms of taboos. So there is, I think there is something in common there, actually. Yeah, definitely. And the way Maureen makes herself useful is by going to that place that other people just won't go to. And whether that's physically a brave place or just emotionally a precarious place, she is willing to do that. So I think there is something in common, yeah, but I hadn't thought about it until just now.
You can have that one for free.
Thank you. I will be getting it out again.
Can you
This
not?
is such a it's a really interesting process, is this, Anna, because I haven't spoken about the book hardly at all yet. So when you ask me questions, you draw out things that I didn't know were true. So thanks for that. It's really good, actually.
Katie, you are a writer in Brighton. Can you talk a bit about being a writer in the city?
It's a good place to be a writer. There are a lot of writers here, and there's a lot of other artists here, and that's at least as important. As a cultural worker in Leeds, I felt much more isolated. And although, and actually, I spent a lot of time doing projects to bring art to participants that might not have had that opportunity. Whereas here, I think culture is central to the life of the city, and that's a really nice thing. You know, what I do is not bizarre. It's useful. So that's really a good reason to be here. New Writing South, that I sit on the board on, is the sort of writing agency for the southeast, and through working with New Writing South, and I guess volunteering, I've met lots of writers too. So it's a community here.
How can we find and follow you, Katie, and get our hands on All Our Sinners?
I'm on Twitter now, X, as Tangle Roots One, but you can search my name. And I well, the will be lots of material from Are We Home Yet online. So I've got interviews, and I've got excerpts, and of course I've got an Amazon page. So there's lots of ways to find out about me.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all. Thanks so much, Anna. I've really enjoyed it.
Mara's ex, Nico, is the girl of her dreams. Beautiful, wild, and unpredictable. She's Mara's everything, even though Mara's never sure she's Nico's anything. Then Nico goes missing. New Year's Day, a girl is rescued from the sea. She knows she is called Nico, but other than that, she has no memory of why she was in the sea or what came before. When destiny reunites them, is this Mara and Nico's second chance? Can their relationship make it out of the shallows? And what will happen when they discover the truth behind Nico's accident? Because one day, Nico will remember everything. Tanya Byrne, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the publication of In the Shallows. How do you feel?
Yeah, it feels it. This feeling kind of never goes away, I think. And I think if it does, I'll give it all up. But it's just so exciting, and I'm just so kind of nervous and anxious, but also in the best possible way to find out what people think of Mara's story.
So you are the queen of, if you don't mind me saying, sapphic romance. I'm proclaiming you as the queen, therefore you are.
Thank you, Anna. I appreciate it.
And what was the inspiration behind this book, which follows the critically acclaimed and TikTok sensation Afterlove?
Well, Afterlove kind of was born out of my mother passing away and kind of a lot of the feelings of grief that went along with it. And, you know, being a writer, my way of dealing and processing with it was to write through it. And this book is sort of similar in the sense that there are so many memories that we have of our childhood. And with my mum gone, they've gone as well. and all of those stories that I grew up with, I can't go back and check details on or ask further questions because it's all pretty much gone. And my mum, I love her. And actually, our entire family are quite the storytellers. And they're not always true. It's slightly embellished, slightly exaggerated. And I can't now know whether or not how much of those stories were true and how much of it was, you know, them entertaining us. So this is essentially a book about memory and the fallibility of memory and what it's like to be 15, almost 16, and you don't know who you are yet and you've already lost that. And so you're at the mercy of everyone around you to kind of remind you who you are when you don't know who you are yet. So that's kind of where it came from, about, you know, growing into who you are and who other people think you are and who you actually want to be and kind of navigating the gulf between the two.
So one thing I've noticed is that the sea often plays quite a big part in your writing. Mm-hmm. Is this something that's conscious?
No, but I think it's unavoidable when you live in Brighton. I actually live very close to the sea. If you go to the top of my road, it's there. And I walk my dog along the beach a lot. And if I'm ever feeling overwhelmed or, you know, claustrophobic or whatever, just going down to the sea really helps kind of open up my mind and my brain and helps me to think more clearly. So the sea is just like this constant in my life. It's the constant soundtrack. When it's really rough, I can hear it from where I live. And it's just always there, I guess. And so I guess it's inevitable that it would make its way into my writing.
So let's go back to In the Shallows. Do you remember the moment that Mara's voice came to you? Because it's written in the first person, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Mara, see, the difficulty is when you write books is that you want to make them sound very distinctive. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want Mara to be Ash 2.0 and, you know, Ash being the protagonist in Afterlove. So it does take a while to get into that, to find her voice, because you have the plot and you have the setting and, you know, you might have your little playlists. And if you do Pinterest boards or whatever, that's not really my thing. But if that's your thing, you know, every writer has a different way of kind of setting up. And I'm in that process right now with my next book. So it just took it takes a minute to kind of get into the groove, I suppose. And for her to take the wheel, I always describe it as, you know, that you can plot everything out, but at some point the character has to take the wheel, and then halfway through the book they're like, yeah, I'm not doing that, or I'm not saying that, and then that's it, you know, you're off. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was what has become the first chapter, when Mara is introducing herself to us and her life, that I'm like, yeah, this is her, this is my girl. And I just remember just this feeling of relief, and then also just responsibility, really, to tell her story as honestly and as beautifully as I could.
Now probably seems like a lovely time for us to hear some. Are you happy to read an extract?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, that was a really good seg, wasn't it? And it wasn't completely unplanned, but we'll pretend that it was. So I'm just going to read you I'm just going to read the prologue and the first chapter. So here we go. I want to tell you a story. It's not one for the history books. No one is going to sing songs about us or write poems about us. In 50 years, you won't find a statue of us standing side by side, hand in hand, mottled with moss, the tips of our fingers and nose chewed. Still, it's a story as old as time. Girl meets girl, girl loses girl, girl gets girl back. I know what you're thinking. You've heard this story before, right? Well, this one isn't simple, but when are these things ever simple? Her name is Nico Rudolph, and I love her. She loves me as well, and while there have been times when I've questioned that, she does. You should know that now, because there will be times that you'll question it as well. Before I get into all of that, though, I suppose I should tell you who I am. If I'm being honest, and I'm truly trying to be, there isn't much to tell. Until I met Nico, I had a quiet life. My parents are still together, still love each other in that unreachable, uncontainable way that makes me ache sometimes. And you're okay. My quiet life hasn't always been quiet. Being the only Desi girl in my class isn't always easy. And the whole I prefer girls thing definitely isn't easy, even if saying it out loud finally made something in me quieten. Even so, I've never felt different. Until I met her, I moved through life without leaving a dent, like the stiff red velvet sofa in my grandparents' living room that forgets you as soon as you stand up. I am extraordinary only in my ordinariness. I do well at school, but I'm not destined to go to Oxford or Cambridge or anything. I can't dance like my mother or cook like my father or sing like Nico. I can't draw or paint or speak any other languages apart from a bit of Hindi. And I hate sport, hate chasing things or kicking things or aiming things at impossible targets. Hate anything that requires me to run or to wear a shirt with a number on the back. So I'm not going to cure cancer or change the world in any meaningful Pulitzer Prize winning way. And I'm okay with that, especially after what happened to Nico. Trust me, having a quiet life is no bad thing. I'm probably too young to know that, but if there's one good thing to come out of all of that, all of this, it's that. I'm lucky. I have a great friend group who, like my parents, love me with a ferocity and a constancy that now I think about it kind of ruined me because I thought that's how everyone would love me. I guess that's another thing I'm probably too young to know. Not everyone can love you in the way that you need to be loved. Still, I've had it pretty easy, other than being charged with fancying every girl I speak to or the odd casually cruel comment in the corridor at school. I've never been bullied. I've never had to walk a different way home or complain about period pain so I don't have to go to school. Never had to endure more than the usual adolescent tragedies, fights with friends, fruitless crushes, failed exams, things that felt so much bigger and more impassable until I met Nico and realised that I didn't have anything to worry about. Except I do, of course. We all do. We all have those things only we know. You never know the secret things that people cry themselves to sleep over, the things they'll never tell you, the things that make their lives, their easy lives, not so easy, the things that distract them, derail them, stop them from being bold enough to hope that there's more than this, even if there's nothing wrong with this. That's who I am, isn't it? Who I really am. Not just the girl in the photographs of birthdays and holidays that line the walls of my house. Not just the star of my parents' stories, the ones they tell at the end of weddings after the cake's been cut and they've had too much champagne. Or when a song comes on the radio and they turn to one another and smile, then turn to me and smile a little wider. I'm every mistake I've made, every scar I've earned. I'm in the songs I listen to on repeat, in the clothes I'm not brave enough to wear, and the sentences I underline in books. That's who I am. Not just the me everyone knows, the me who is chronically early for everything and hates kidney beans and overwatered succulents, but I'm all the things I'm too scared to say out loud as well. I'm every hope, every fear, every wild thought that makes me weak and woozy with the promise of something else, something beyond me, beyond the borders of photographs on my parents' stories and this tiny corner of the universe that I tread. I'm more than what people think they know, more than this endless, exhausting feeling of something shifting, trying to make space, but there isn't enough room. Mara Malachar, only child of Vasuda and Madeira, born in Brighton and still here, still in the house on Toronto Terrace my parents brought me back to 16 years ago, still in the bedroom overlooking the garden, the one my father painted pink before I was born and has been every conceivable colour since then. Mara Malachar, who is bad with numbers and instructions but always answers her phone, who reads too many books and loves words, even if until now they've been contained to the corners of my notebooks that are too pretty to use. Other people's words knotted with my own, lyrics and lines from stories that make me lightheaded with relief that a stranger could know something about me before I did. Scruffy ink and paper time capsules of whatever I was feeling, which, I told myself, I didn't need to feel once I'd written it down. But I want to feel it this time. Even though this is also very tender, and every time I put any weight on those tender parts, I'm reluctant to do it again. And I'm even more reluctant to write it down in case I dilute it somehow, because I can't find the right words to articulate the misery and magic of it all. But I must, because I'm terrified if I don't, I'll forget. Memory is fickle, isn't it? It can fail you when you need it most. It lies to you, convinces you that something happened when it didn't. it will erase the things that matter, like hearing someone laugh for the first time and knowing it's a prelude to some great joy to come, and replace it with a tiny, thoughtless comment that returns to you months after you said it, unexpected and uninvited, to make you doubt who you are. That's why I need to write this down now before I forget. So forgive me if this isn't perfect, but that's another thing I've learned. Things don't need to be perfect. They just need to be true.
Thank you so much. It's such a strong opening. I get really fangirly. What I really love about your writing is how you mix really intense love stories and really real realism with this kind, these kind of magical elements that always feel really effortless and kind of very, very flowing, for want of a better word. Is that something that has always really inspired you, kind of bringing magic into real life?
I think so. I think, I mean, I always say, and people laugh, that I write contemporary because I can't write fantasy because I don't have much of an imagination, which sounds like a strange thing for a writer to say. But the truth is, you know, I don't think, my brain doesn't work in that fantastical way of, you know, fairies and witches and, you know, dragons or whatever in space. For me, it's about finding the beauty in the ordinary, which is what, you know, Andy Warhol says, you've got to find the most ordinary thing and find the beauty in it. So it's the everyday magic and seeing the magic in everything. And it could be, you know, something as simple as a sunset, or, you know, walking into a shop and hearing your favourite song and thinking that they've played it for you. And that is what I look for in the everyday. And I think that's what gets us through life, really, is finding those small moments, especially when things are really rough. And when, and you know, there's a line in The Shallows that says that you have to be really brave to be 15. And I think that's true. I think you need to find something to get you through each day. And if that is a sunset, then it's a sunset.
You really capture the kind of multitudes of being a young queer teenager so beautifully.
Thank you.
It made me wonder what books you grew up reading and whether or not you saw yourself and your experiences reflected in them.
It's really strange because I was asked this yesterday in another interview and I didn't have an answer, because this, I mean, YA isn't a genre, it's actually a section in a bookshop, but still these books didn't exist when I was growing up. We had like Judy Blume. So I remember kind of all the books at school, because I grew up in a house that didn't have any books. We had like the encyclopedias, Britannica, which my mum was very proud of, we weren't allowed to touch. But other than that, we didn't have any books. She wasn't the read you a bedtime story before bed sort of mum, but that's okay because she had three jobs and she was a nurse and she was exhausted. So I don't blame her in the slightest. So I kind of read what I had to read for school. So Jane Eyre and The Hobbit and To Kill a Mockingbird. And then what we did have, which I was very lucky for with hindsight, was our school had a library. So we would spend a lot of time there, like, you know, when the weather was bad or whatever. And my friend, and I probably shouldn't name her on a podcast, but Melanie McPherson, if you're out there and listening, she found a copy of Forever by Judy Blume. And I remember she was reading it out loud, and Sister Alice, because I went to a convent school, caught us and confiscated it. I was absolutely mortified. But I remember kind of moving on from Judy Blume and jumping straight to stuff like Jackie Collins and Julie Cooper. And then I just stopped reading for a really long time. So no, books didn't really play a huge part in my upbringing, in my childhood. And the ones that I did read absolutely did not represent me in the slightest. It's still, even now as a 47-year-old, I still struggle to find books that I feel seen in. It's a lot better than it was, but yeah, it's still not as common as it might be for you, for example.
Absolutely. It really, that leads me really nicely onto my next question, because you are passionate about championing underrepresented writers. And I'd really like to know what advice you'd give to people who might be listening, who are writers who don't necessarily see themselves or that they have a place in this strange industry?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I feel very strongly about because it breaks my heart sometimes to think about all the people who have stories to tell but will never read them because they don't have the resources or the confidence or whatever it is that's stopping them. And I'm concerned, especially the way that things are going with this current government, but we'll leave it like that, defunding the arts and not supporting the arts means that only certain people that who can afford to will tell their stories, in which case that only certain stories will be told. And I think that is a really scary thing and something that I will fight against with everything that I've got, because I think if we're ever going to involve and move forward, I think empathy is a huge part of that. And books are a really, really good way of a good vehicle for empathy and for getting you to experience things beyond your own. And I think that's all, the word woke is often used, as a weapon now. And I think wokeness is just being aware of experiences beyond your own. That's it. That's all it is. Having an appreciation and a respect for other people's experiences. That's it. There's no conspiracy here. And books are a great way of doing that. My advice would be to hold your nerve, really, and just keep trying. I know it's hard. I don't have a creative writing degree. I didn't study creative writing in any way. Like I said, I didn't read a lot growing up. I honestly don't know where I came from. And there will be people listening to this now that feel the same way, that you know words and you know what order they should go in sometimes, and you don't know why, and you don't know what an adjective is or a noun is or whatever, but you just know. And that is a gift that needs to be explored. And I don't think it's vanity, and I don't think it's selfish. And I think if you want to, and you're looking for permission, then let me be the one to give you that permission right now to say that you should explore that curiosity. And I'm not naive enough to say, give up your job and try and write a book. What I did was I earmarked every Sunday as a writing day. And whatever happened, that Sunday was sacrosanct. And I wrote on that Sunday. And if I couldn't write on that Sunday because it was someone's birthday or was at a wedding or whatever, I would switch it to the Saturday, or maybe the following weekend, do the Saturday and the Sunday. And then during the week, I would take my laptop and I would edit in my lunch break at work. And that's how I did it. And if you have to get up 2 hours late, 2 hours earlier, or stay up 2 hours later, if you really want to do this, you will find a way. And in the meantime, yeah, there's loads of advice online, there's courses, there's people that will help. But for me, reading was the biggest thing, was just getting a book that you love and finding out, why did you love this book? What was it about that fight scene? Or what was it about that argument? Or what was it about that kiss? Or what was it about that description that you love? And really read the book in a different way. I have friends that have kind of literally torn books apart and kind of like spread them out and done, like, so this is the first act, this is the second act, da, 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 and just kind of working it out. So there are ways of doing it, and actually it's the job that you just honestly just need a pen and a piece of paper, and you can get going. So just start with what you have and just make it, be as honest as you can and write. Just do not overthink it. Just write. Don't think about what will sell and what people are looking for. And because the thing is, as soon as you start thinking like that, you're done, because publishing is so slow. So say, for example, say there was a trend with vampires, that would be done by the time your book comes out. So there's no point trying to write that now. So just be honest, and if there's something you want to say, say it.
That's excellent advice. Thank you so much. Tanya, how can we find and follow you?
I am on Instagram, Tanya Byrne at Instagram, and then my website is tanyabyrne.com. And I also have a TikTok that I never use called Tanya Byrne Author, but I'm going to try and maybe use it a little bit more but I'm very scared. I don't know what to do with the TikTok. But they're very excited. Whenever I go on there, they're very excited. So that's good. And I think BookTok is one of the most exciting things to happen in publishing for a very long time.
Thank you so much for joining us. In the Shallows is out now with all good retailers. Thank you for listening to the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to yours. We'll see you next month.